Now, the extraordinary actions of senior military leaders who feared a possible coup in the final weeks of Donald Trump's presidency by the president himself. Carol Leonig is a national investigative reporter at the Washington Post and a three-time Pulitzer Prize winner. Her latest book, co-written with Philip Rucker, reveals the concerns the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, had regarding the intentions of the president. As traversed in last month's Senate hearing, Chairman Milley asked his fellow military leaders to advise him if they believed the president might launch a nuclear weapon, as a distraction to the ructions of his final months and weeks in office, and became so worried that the president might try to deploy the military to remain in power, effectively attempting a coup, that Milley and other top officials discussed ways to stop him. Leonig and Rucker's book, I Alone Can Fix This, reveals just how far the military leaders were prepared to go within constitutional boundaries to try to thwart any such move. They say, the authors say, Milley considered the situation the president's, quote, Reichstag moment. I asked Carol Leonig, to whom the authors spoke, to build up such a detailed picture of the president's final weeks and months in office.
For this book, we interviewed more than 140 people who were either friends, advisors, close confidants, cabinet members, national security officials, and also family members, to try to get a feeling for what it was like to be in the room with Donald Trump on one of the most historic and really perilous years in our country's history.
One standout part of the book, especially given recent events, is the part referring to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley. He's referred to in several parts, but in one context in particular, we see some quite startling information. But before we go on to that, what did you make of General Milley's recent appearance before a Senate committee last month, where he defended his actions in the final months of President Donald Trump, his then boss? And look, extraordinary information there, Carol. You know, General Milley insisting that calls to his Chinese counterpart in a meeting where he told generals to alert him if the president tried to launch a nuclear weapon were part of his duties as the country's top military officer. It's surreal watching this from a distance.
Yes, so many elements of Chairman Milley's experience in those last few months, Catherine, were indeed surreal and hair-raising, right? Because here is the most senior career Pentagon official that we have. He's a military official, but ultimately he's apolitical. And he's being drawn into a political psychodrama that he's never experienced except in history books. And he ultimately comes to the conclusion that Donald Trump is behaving more like Adolf Hitler than a American presidential predecessor. In the instance you mention, he is very fearful of whether or not the president might try to do something nuts, you know, might try to do something to put the country at war, if only to distract the people from the fact that he's lost the election. In our reporting for our book, I Alone Can Fix It, Phil Rucker and I learned that he really believed there was a coup afoot, that people that were close to the president and the White House itself were trying to egg on an ability to keep Trump in power. And he believed they were going to try to use the military to do this. And he pledged to his dying day, you know, I'm not going to let them get their hands on the guys with the guns. And he worked like the Dickens to avoid that.
Let's work this through in some sort of order. Because as a starting point, they actually got on quite well, as you report it. In fact, it was General Mattis, who I think was Secretary of Defense, was not happy about Mark Milley's appointment to this role. He wanted someone else for it. As you report it, they got on well in a meeting, Trump and Milley, and seemed to sort of get each other, understand each other. So what happened to the relationship over time?
You know, it's funny. It was, it's not so funny. It was all downhill. I mean, it was a false friendship in one respect, or false working relationship, because Donald Trump really chose Milley because Mattis didn't like him. And essentially, the president was choosing the enemy of my enemy. And he believed that because Mattis didn't like Milley, that bode well for the two men to get along well. And it did for a time, but not long, because on June 1, Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, declared to his friends and to his close confidants that the president had played him. He felt that he had been used in a political photo op when the president, basically ordering all of his federal law enforcement agencies through the White House officials to clear a entire Washington park where protesters typically gather, and where peaceful protesters were gathered that day, all so the president could stride across that park, look forceful, and present the impression that he was in charge of Washington, and protesters outside of his house were not going to take over the city. The chairman was mad because he was wearing his, you know, camouflage fatigues that you wear basically into battle, or that you wear on the street for important exercises, military exercises, and it made it look like the military was behind Trump. And Milley was pissed off about that.
This was the notorious Lafayette Square walk with a Bible in hand from memory, and tear gas and rubber bullets were used to clear protesters. And General Mattis himself, again, criticising Mark Milley over this. But Mark Milley, as you write it, was himself immensely frustrated by it. Was that the pivotal loss of confidence in each other's relationship?
Absolutely. It was the beginning of the end, because Milley concludes that he's been played. He also concludes that the president is willing to cross lines that are unethical and for pure personal political gain. And he feels very sure, and he turns out to be right, that the president's willing to use the military in any way that he can for his personal benefit. That really ruffles Milley the wrong way. But it also puts him on guard, because he decides he has to publicly apologize for this. The president privately chides him and says, "What are you apologizing for? You can walk with your president, can't you?" But it begins this, you know, fissure of distrust between the two men, because Milley knows what Trump is up to. And Trump now wonders, is Milley really my guy? Is he loyal to me? And what worsens the situation is that Milley discovers over that summer and over that fall that the president is yet willing to cross more lines. He's willing to try to use the military to quash protests all around the country. He wants to sick the active duty military on people who are protesting the death of George Floyd. Remember, a black man killed with a knee to the neck when he is not resisting officers in any way, shape, or form and is not a threat, is killed in 9 seconds on a city street by a police officer holding him in an illegal hold. And the president is on the side of those who think that George Floyd should have been killed. This is also incredibly frustrating to Milley, because he doesn't want the military to be pointing guns and real bullets at protesters of racism in our country.
Obviously, the handling of the pandemic, which you describe as the president's first true crisis in office, is one of the significant sections of the book. But we're focusing on what you describe as a second crisis, and you argue that the president chose to spawn that crisis. In your words, you say the subversion of democracy. What were you told by the sources you interviewed about how the situation emerged and how the decisions the president consciously made as we began to move towards the end of his tenure?
So many things, Catherine. Well, first of all, I still get a little bit of a tingle up my spine when I think about sitting down in the homes and offices and tea shops with very, very senior presidential advisors who confided to me and to my co-author, Phil Rucker, that even though they were huge supporters of the president, they felt that he was putting the country in danger. They felt that he was putting democracy on the railroad tracks to dissolution. And he was a national security threat. They were afraid of the degree to which he was willing to put democracy in the crosshairs, essentially. And some of those key moments were when the president spouted back to the American public things that his advisors had told him were falsehoods, that the election was rigged. This claim that the president was making after the election, that it had been stolen from him, that there were all sorts of states where untold fraud had been perpetrated, all of that was malarkey. And he knew it because his attorney general had told him. His attorney general, Bill Barr, had sat with him in a room and said, "Mr. President, I appreciate that you're worried about fraud, and some fraud may have happened, but I have an entire team of investigators looking into the claims that your colleagues and supporters are making and Republican Party officials are making in Arizona, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio. And I'm telling you, Mr. President, it's all bull S. Forgive me." And that was his exact words to the president. He said, "This is bull. I've looked at it. My people have looked at it." But the president kept telling people that. And it was part of really like a kind of a slipshod plot, because Bill Barr learned, the attorney general learned, the night before the election from a White House friend that the president was planning all along to claim victory, whether he won or not. That this was in his mind, that if he could just claim victory before the election night ended, he could stir the pot, he could stir distrust, and his supporters would believe him because they had believed him about many things before.
How early was the evidence from your sources that that was the plan? How early in election year?
Well, obviously, as well told by my newspaper, The Washington Post, and wonderful colleagues there, the president had begun a campaign to raise questions about mail-in ballots as early as, you know, May of 2020. Now, his own advisors, his own political campaign advisors, were telling him, you know, you could lose votes if you keep trying to discourage people about mail-in ballots. This is a way during COVID that people are voting, and it's not just Democrats who want to vote this way. You could hurt your turnout. He didn't listen to them. But he was clearly already stoking this idea that maybe the election wasn't going to be legit. And he said it a million different ways. What we learned in more detail, Catherine, from our sources, was that it was very organized. He and a small coterie of true believers were starting in the early fall to start to concoct a way that they could claim, no matter what, that he had won.
Were they within the White House, or were they within the Republican Party in the Congress? Because there are clearly those within the party who enabled or supported or repeated the claims both before and after the election. But were there, you're clearly talking about people working in the administration who were concerned and who were taking action. Were any in the administration part of this?
According to our sources, absolutely. There were people in the administration who were part of this, people in the White House who were egging on the president. Now, I have to say that there were some people who were fairly straddling the situation. And a good example is Mark Meadows, the chief of staff at the White House. This is the person that in our history in the country has always been sort of the big cop, the police officer who makes sure the president's will is done and also makes sure the president doesn't make any huge errors and mistakes. But in this case, the White House chief of staff was so slavish in his adoration of the president that he didn't want to tell the president anything he didn't want to hear. Now, there were people who would come to Mark Meadows and say to him, "You have got to get him to stop saying the election was rigged." And Meadows would tell them, "I'm working on it. I'm working on it. We're trying to get him to concede." But to the president's face, Mark Meadows was singing a different tune, according to our sources. To the president's face, he was repeatedly encouraging his version of reality, which of course was poppycock.
Hi, and speaking to Carol Leonick, she is with Philip Rucker, co-author of I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. Carol, let's come back to Mark Milley, to Chairman Milley. At what point did he begin getting genuinely concerned about the intentions of the president at the end of his tenure, to the extraordinary degree that we've heard?
You know, this comparison that Milley was starting to see between Adolf Hitler and Donald Trump really hit its first crescendo in the days after the election. The president was upset about, obviously, the results, refused to concede, gave a slightly unsettling and disturbing speech in the middle of the night after the election, in which he said, frankly, we did win, despite all evidence to the contrary. And he began talking about how he was the person who was going to protect the Americans from this terrible theft. He was going to stop the steal. And of course, Milley, already on guard about June 1 and the clearing of Lafayette Square, the authoritarian impulses of Donald Trump, already, you know, twice bitten, three times shy by the president insisting all summer long that they activate active duty military to point guns and threaten and quash the protests around the city of George Floyd's murder. Now it's the third count of concern, and that is the president's refusing a safe and civil transfer of power. And it's very upsetting to Milley. And according to people we interviewed who he spoke with very candidly, he described it as the gospel of the Führer, that this was a Reichstag moment where the president was trying to claim there was some horrible injustice and a threat to the country that he alone could fix, that he alone would be able to save them from. And that really reminded him quite a bit of the emergencies and catastrophes of the Reichstag fire that ultimately led to Hitler's rise in power.
He is a student of history, we should say, for context, Chairman Milley, but he literally used those words.
He did. And, you know, as a student of history, when you've done your work and you start actually saying someone resembles Hitler and the moment resembles the Reichstag fire, you know, you really set the rest of your team into a near panic. Many of them were very worried about what this might portend. And Milley himself, in talking with the chairman of the joint, the other joint chiefs that he helped supervise, the Secretary of the Army, Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary of the Navy, Coast Guard, when these folks got together with Milley, they began talking that fall about how would they basically block the president from giving them an order they couldn't refuse. As a military officer, you are not allowed to resist a legal military order. If it's illegal, you can say no. But a legal one that is horribly dangerous and horribly unethical, you actually aren't supposed to resist. And these chiefs were talking, how can we stop him? How can we throw our bodies in front of a decision to use the military that we believe is really an effort by President Trump to either sow panic, distraction, or consolidate his own power? And they began discussing a reverse Saturday Night Massacre. For your New Zealand listeners who aren't familiar with the Nixon era, the Saturday Night Massacre was a moment when several attorneys general serially resigned, and they were replaced by another person who then resigned as well in order not to carry out President Nixon's order about tapes and evidence that were very damning about his actions.
So what were the generals and the secretaries' plan? What were the military leaders' plan B for their version of the Saturday Night Massacre?
Yeah. So in the military here in the United States, Every one of these individuals has a legal duty to give the president their best military advice. And so the president, if he gave them an order, each one of them planned they would insist on being given an audience so that they could give him their best military advice. And if he still resisted it, they would resign. And then when the president was about to ask the next person in line to deploy his order, to execute his demand, that person would then ask for an audience to give his best political advice. And if it was not accepted, he would resign. It was a slow motion stalling tactic that they had worked out to block the president with their own bodies if he ordered them to do something that they thought would hurt the country and hurt the democracy.
Milley was questioned about this at the recent Senate committee. Do you believe there are constitutional questions raised by his or others' actions, or have they managed to operate within constitutional propriety?
You know, I am not a lawyer in constitutional law, but I will tell you that from my study of this, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, no matter who fills that role, it takes an oath to the Constitution, not to the president. That person is supposed to be above politics. Their number one goal is the protection of our country and its national security. And Milley was operating, from all the reporting that I've done, under the rubric that he was protecting the national security of our country. And that's his job. So it's hard to imagine that he crossed any wires. And as I think you know from watching these hearings and watching this unfold, the rest of the presidency now, the rest of the Biden administration and the Secretary of Defense have said out loud they have nothing but good faith in General Milley, and it's not for political reasons, but for the reasons that he looked out for the homeland.
Another matter that occurred just before the January 6th storming of the Capitol, extraordinary scenes, was this action of all of the then living former Secretaries of Defence, again raising their concerns about the President. Just remind us what unfolded there, and again, what was known in advance about what may or may not happen on January 6th?
You know, now looking back, it feels as though there was such a clear roadmap of what was going to happen January 6th. Some people took it seriously and believed there was some danger brewing and that there was a storm coming and that it could involve violence. And many other people did not. They did not see it coming. They did not believe there was a violent plan to overthrow the democracy and overturn the results of one of the most closely and carefully monitored elections in American history. But now we can all see that in basically days after the election, President Trump was grasping at straws to figure out a legal way he could overturn the results. And when he discovered that there was not such a way, he determined that he was going to get Pence to claim there was a legal way to reject the election returns. And then it became clear, when Pence was not going to do that, that they were going to have all of these, you know, people in the streets take to the streets and defend their president, despite the fact that the results had already been determined at the ballot box. One of the most frightening things, Catherine, was when a former national security advisor, a longtime ally of Donald Trump's, said that and declared it in December that the president should seize the ballot boxes in swing states and, quote unquote, declare martial law and rerun the election. Well, you know, in America, we don't rerun elections that are fairly and carefully monitored and that are accurate. That is something that happens perhaps in Putin's Russia or in other authoritarian countries. We don't rerun elections. When he started talking about using the military to do that, secretaries of defense from former years sort of got shivers up their spine. But also there was something else going on behind the scenes, which is that Liz Cheney knew from her colleagues that Republican lawmakers in the Tea Party caucus were meeting with Donald Trump and were cooking up something for January 6th, cooking up a way to block that certification. Now, of course, the president made it clear he was going to use Vice President Pence to block that election, but he had another weapon in his arsenal, and that was, of course, the hordes of supporters who came to his rally and eventually stormed the Capitol.
There were concerns also ahead of the inauguration, and for all of this behaviour, the president never conceded that he lost the election, but there was a peaceful transfer of power. So how much of this whole carry-on was, you know, a sore loser, desperate not to lose, brinkmanship, hyperbole, strutting about, and how much of this was a potentially to be realised threat of the scale that Chairman Milley was concerned about, an actual coup?
Right, right. You know, it's actually the most important question, the one you just posed. And so many sources that I spoke to inside the Trump administration for this book felt very quivery about this question. Quivery because they believed that Donald Trump had a goal of stopping and overturning this election. But they also believed that essentially he hadn't been disciplined and organized and focused enough to get it done. That sounds, you know, a little bit disparaging, but they basically warned me that what Donald Trump showed us is it's possible. And if there were someone who came along with the same populist message, with the same savior kind of complex and the conspiracy theories that he was so successful in promoting, if that person had been a little more rigorous and disciplined in their stratagems, they might have been able to pull it off. This really rested on Pence. And what if Vice President Pence, on the night of January 6th, hadn't insisted on staying in the building to finish the work of certifying the election? What if he had not taken that duty seriously?
Do you believe that Donald Trump will seek the nomination again in 2024? And do you believe that he will be the Republican nominee?
It's a little far out in the distance to say whether he will be the nominee. I know that if he chose to be it today and there was a primary, he would be the nominee. That's the kind of standard bearer he is for the party today. He, in our conversations when I met with him, with Phil and I in Mar-a-Lago, it seemed clear to me he is a man who wants to run in 2024. He's prepping. He's talking the talk. We'll see, because it's some months off. But if it were to be held in the next few months, I would say yes and yes.
That is Carol Leonig, national investigative reporter at The Washington Post, a 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And her latest book, co-written with her colleague Philip Rucker, is called I Alone Can Fix This.